You need two things this morning. One is a sermon outline, which you'll find in your bulletin. It's this white outline. You got to have one of those this morning. You're going to need it. The other one is a Bible. If you don't have one, try to scoot next to somebody who does, because we're going to be looking at Jesus' words this morning in the Sermon on the Mount, and you need both of those two things in order to make the best use of what we're going to be doing together this morning. Let me start out with a sermon outline. Last week, if you recall, we were in the Sermon on the Mount, and we got to the point where Jesus said, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, there's no way you're going to get into the kingdom of God. And we thought, well, you know, that's not any big deal until we began to find out who the scribes and Pharisees were. You remember, the scribes and Pharisees were the religious elite. They were the guys who did everything right. They had 613 commandments that they had extracted from the Old Testament, and they kept every one of them. And Jesus says, you have got to be better than 613 commandments to get into heaven. So today we're going to find out how good we are. Take your sermon outline. Right here I have six of the 613 commandments. You don't have to circle these, but I want you to circle them mentally. We're going to take a little quiz this morning. This represents less than 1% of the commandments that they kept. We'll see how well we measure up. Okay, the first one. These are all true or false, so it makes it real easy. Either you did or you didn't. I have never murdered anyone. True or false? That may be the easiest one on here, by the way. Number two, I have never committed adultery. True or false? Now, it's real important that you're not circling these, particularly if you're sitting next to somebody who may not know about this. Number three, I have never had an illegal divorce. In other words, I've never divorced my spouse without going through the legal procedures, the paperwork, the courts, and all that to make it legal. I've never just dumped somebody and walked away. An illegal divorce. Does everybody understand the difference between a legal and an illegal divorce according to the law? Okay. If you're married again and you committed an illegal divorce, you're a bigamist at this point in time. Okay. Maybe you'll clear it up. Number three, they're getting more difficult. I don't break my vows to God. I never promise God I'll do this and then not follow through on it. Number five, I don't carry out illegal retribution. Now what I mean by that is, if your neighbor drives on your lawn accidentally when they're backing their boat in, you don't take your car and go over and do donuts on their lawn. I got to get back at this guy. He messed with me. I don't carry out illegal retribution. Number six, I love my friends. True or false? I love my friends. Y'all are feeling pretty good at this point in time, aren't you? That was six out of the 613. There's 607 more to go. I figured if we went through them all this morning, it would take too long. And if you're starting to feel good about yourself, you're missing the point of Jesus' sermon. You see, we are in chapter 5, and we're going to start with verse 21 today, and Jesus is going to go through all six of these examples. We're not going to go through all of them this morning. We're only going to take the first two, murder and adultery. Just those two this morning. We'll take two next week, and then we'll take two a couple weeks after that. But we're going to go through and look at these, and what we're going to find out is that Jesus isn't all that concerned about whether you kept or broke the commandments, but about the heart attitude that you have. And we're going to find out that you can commit murder without ever actually killing anybody. You can commit adultery without ever actually slipping in between the sheets with somebody else. You can be guilty in your heart, even though you may not be guilty on the outside. And so when Jesus says, You've got to be better. Your righteousness has got to surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees. What he's saying is, don't focus on the rules, because rules make people religious. And God's not interested in religious people. Jesus is saying, focus on the heart. What do you have inside of you here? Because that's where righteousness comes from. If all God did, and all the power he had, if all he could do was come down here and make you and I kind of cleaned up on the outside and give us this veneer of goodness where we all put a religious smile on our face and we all were real polite and walked around saying yes and smile, yes sir, no sir, yes ma'am, yes. And God would be a real impotent God. God's goal for you and me is to change us at the very core of our being, where our attitudes lie, where our thoughts lie. That's what God's interested in doing. And that's what this passage is all about. So let's look at these passages together this morning, and we're going to see some real insightful things that Jesus presents in the Sermon on the Mount. Look at verse 21. He says, "You have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder.'" Now that phrase, "You have heard that the ancients were told," is real important. He repeats that six times in all six of these examples. He does it in verse 21. If you look down in verse 27, he does it again. If you look down further in verse 31, he does it again. And what's he talking about here? He's talking about the rules of the religious elite. And he's saying this. When they say, "You have heard that it was said of old," that was the sermon that had been preached. That's what they had been listening to for years and years. And what the Pharisees had done, and this was their problem, when you get 613 commandments, they're hard to keep. So what the Pharisees have done is they took the commandment and they said, "How can we do this? I mean, how can we live up to all these standards? What we need to do is take the rule, 'You shall not commit murder,' and narrow it down to the narrowest possible thing that it could be. Narrow it down to the very narrowest interpretation that you could take. To make us be successful, to be able to keep the commandments of God. It makes sense. To narrow that thing down to the least common denominator." We used to do this in Bible college. For those of you who have ever been around a Bible college or something of that nature, everything they do is on the honor system. But it's really not on the honor system, because at the end of the semester they ask you whether you did it or not. And one of the things that we always had trouble with was reading assignments. Because what they'd do in Bible college is they'd give you a syllabus with all of these papers that you're supposed to write and all the stuff you're supposed to memorize and all the tests you were supposed to take. And at the end, invariably, every professor would stick four or five books that came off of his personal best reading list and say, "You've got to read these during the course of the semester." Sometimes 2,000 pages of extra reading. So at the end of the semester, they would ask you on your test, "Did you or did you not do the reading?" And it would count maybe 5 or 10% of your grade. You know what happened? The word "reading" started to be defined in all kinds of different ways. Yeah, now, normally, we don't have a problem with the word "reading." You know, normally, when it's, you know, somebody says "read," we all understand what that means. But in Bible college, people developed all kinds of different interpretations. Of course, there was the strict literalist, and what they believed was that reading meant to read every word. So if there were 2,000 pages, you read every word on those 2,000 pages. Of course, there were the guys that, you know, they said the meaning of a book is contained in the topic sentence of each paragraph. So what reading means is to read the first sentence of each paragraph, and if you read the first sentence of each paragraph, boy, you've got the meaning. And certainly that's what reading means, right? Then there was another group of people, and they believed in the subconscious mind. And they realized that the subconscious mind can always take in far more than the conscious mind could. And so, with that strong belief in the conscious mind, they developed the fan method of reading. And here's how that worked. You take the book and you lay it here on your desk. You take fan and you place it on this side of the book. You sit in your chair, you lean forward, and turn on fan. And your subconscious just takes in all of this information. And at the end of the semester, they could say, yes, we did the reading. I'm not going to tell you which one of those I subscribe to. I did make it through college, though. You see the point? The Pharisees came to all of these rules in the Old Testament, and they said, how in the world can we ever do this? How can we keep all the laws? Well, what is the least, if we could narrow it down to the most narrow interpretation, what would it require to keep this law? And that was their righteousness. Jesus says, no, you've missed the whole point. Look at verse 22, he says, but I say to you, and if you look further down in verse 28, he says, but I say to you. In other words, he's making a statement. You guys have preached this way all your lives, and everybody's heard it preached this way. But I'm going to tell you something different. I'm going to tell you what God really intended by giving the Old Testament laws. You see, the religious man, he narrows the laws of God. But the righteous man, he broadens them. The religious man asks, how can I keep the rules to impress God? The righteous man says, how can I change my heart to please God? The religious man, his measure of success is, how do I look? How do I look? The righteous man, his measure of success is, what am I like? What am I really like? When there's nobody else around except me and God, what am I really like deep down at the core of my being? Well, let's dive into the first one of these. I doubt in this crowd that there are any murderers here. Or are there? Verse 21. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. And whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. That the Pharisees' interpretation of the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, was you shall not commit a physical act of taking another person's life. And that's what God intended by that commandment, right? Not according to Jesus. Look what Jesus says. Verse 22, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Boy, Jesus changes things there, doesn't he? See, the Pharisees, their interpretation was, don't commit a physical act of murder. That's all you have to do to be righteous before God. Jesus says, if you're angry with your brother, you're already guilty. If you're angry with your brother, you've already broken God's law. You see, God recognizes that killing starts in the heart. And the hand that holds the gun is connected to a homicidal heart. Killing another person starts long before you take their physical life. And when you and I begin to kill somebody, whether we're doing it in our mind or whether we're doing it in our heart through anger and bitterness, we've broken God's law. You see, the whole focus has changed. It's not just on the physical outward act, but it's on the intent of the heart. The word anger is a brooding, simmering anger that is nurtured and nurtured. Y'all know what I'm talking about. When somebody does something to you or somebody says something to you, somebody may cheat you or malign you or whatever, and you start to get this gut feeling that begins to well up inside and just grows and grows. You find yourself laying your head on your pillow at night kind of wondering how you could get back at that person. Well, if I had a chance, you know, what would be the ideal scenario? Some of you guys start thinking, you know, wouldn't it be great if that area of business took a downturn and just to be able to watch that guy drowned? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be nice, you know, that woman that said those mean things about me, wouldn't it be nice if somebody would just really embarrass her? Just really embarrass her. I know in high school, some of you guys, wouldn't it be nice if the biggest kid would just come up and punch that guy out? I'm just so sick of being humiliated. And that brooding anger starts to build inside, and it just builds and builds and builds and grows. And Jesus Christ says that when you begin to have that going on inside of you, you're guilty already. It's real important here, though, to make a differentiation between the anger and the killing. You know, the common one is the next one we're going to talk about in Ann Landers. You know, people write in and they say, or Dear Abby, whichever paper you happen to get, they write in and say, well, you know, since looking on a woman to lust after her is adultery, why not go ahead and do the act? Well, you're saying, well, if Jesus says you're guilty, if you get angry, why not just go ahead and kill the person? That's not what he's saying here. Look at the progression. He says, first of all, anyone who is angry with his brother is guilty before the court, and then whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and then the one who says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into fiery hell. He's talking about levels of guilt here. It gets worse and worse and worse. He hadn't even got to anger or to murder yet. So basically, here's what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying at the point in time when you get angry, you're guilty. When you go one step further and begin to express that anger, raka, you're more guilty. When you get more angry and you express that anger, you fool, you're more guilty. And when you actually pull out the gun and shoot the guy, you've committed the ultimate act. But don't focus on this one and forget about those. Because that is what God came to change in your heart. To give you the ability not to even have to start down this road of guilt and worse and worse and worse. Well, there are a couple terms that we've got to define here. Y'all are sitting out there thinking, what in the world does raka mean? And when's the last time you said raka to somebody? The term raka is basically a transliteration because the English didn't have an exact word to put in here. And the term raka means empty, and it refers to the head. Y'all get the idea? Terms that we might use today would be, you brainless idiot, you stupid fool, you blockhead. Now, none of y'all have ever been driving down the road and used any of these terms. I know that. If y'all are like me, you feel this hand come over and grab you by the leg. Last time I preached this passage, the very next day, when I was driving down the road, I said, you idiot, because the guy cut me off in the road. And Cindy said, Tim, good point. Good illustration. So, basically, raka is a murder of somebody's self-worth. It's when you look at another person and you begin to verbally assassinate their self-worth. You idiot, you fool, you can't do anything right. You know, the place where I fear this is done the most is in our homes with our kids. How many kids, in an indirect way or even in a direct way, hear it over and over again? You can't do anything right. In a fit of anger where you've told that child over and over again, don't do that, don't do that, and they do it again, and all of a sudden it just comes flying out of our mouths. You stupid idiot. What's wrong with you? You can't do anything right. You're just worthless. Jesus says, at that point in time, you've killed that child, and you're guilty because you've assassinated their self-worth. Some of you may be here as adults and be suffering under the burden of having a mom or a dad that all of your life told you you'd never amount to anything. You're worthless. You're stupid. And you've struggled with that your whole life. You felt insecure. You felt like your value was no good at all. And you know what it's like to die the death of being assassinated in your character. When a person says, raka, are they guilty? Boy, they sure are. And if all God could do is just prevent us from pulling the trigger on each other, would we have a great society? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The change has got to happen in here. Second term the term you fool, the term that's strong enough to send somebody into hell, is the term in the Greek moros. I bet you can't guess which word we get from moros. Our English word is moron. And that also means empty, but it refers more to the character of a person. The character of a person. Something we might say to somebody else is, you scoundrel, you sleaze, you've got bad character. That's murder. That's the murder of the character. And how many times in conversation with somebody else have you heard somebody's character murdered? Where all of a sudden you hear this, pss, 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 and you're talking to somebody and they start telling you about, boy, you know, I think we really need to pray for this person because I heard yesterday that they were doing such and such and such and such, and boy, you know, I just can't imagine anybody getting involved in that kind of activity, and this is just terrible, and all of a sudden this person's character is murdered. In the same way, when we do that, we're guilty. When we destroy somebody else, we're guilty before God. This happens all the time. I was invited to a family reunion about several years ago, and I went to the family reunion, and I was talking to the person that invited me, and the person that invited me was telling me that half the family wasn't there, and I began to question why, and the response was, well, my dad and his brother got in an argument at a family reunion about 10 years ago, and now half the family doesn't speak to the other half of the family. Does that describe your family? It's pretty common. How many businesses have split up because the two partners got angry at each other and couldn't get along? How many friendships are broken up because one person gets mad at another person and carries a grudge indefinitely? How many relationships between fathers and sons, between mothers and daughters, are destroyed because of anger? You see, guilt starts at the moment of anger. And Jesus Christ says, you're not righteous if you're brooding and harboring anger inside. Well, what to do? He gives us something that we can do about it. Look at verse 23. He says, therefore, if you are presenting your offerings at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. This is in the context of worship. And in Israel, what a person would be doing would be coming into the temple with a lamb to sacrifice for his sin. And he'd be bringing this lamb into the altar, up to the altar. And Jesus says, when you're walking in with that lamb to lay it before God and say, God, I worship you. I want to be clean before you. I want to pray to you. You're bringing the lamb down the altar to be sacrificed, and you get the lamb halfway down there, down to the altar, and all of a sudden you realize, you know, I've got a conflict going on with my brother. And it doesn't really differentiate between who starts it. He says, if your brother's got something against you, I mean, even if the other guy's got the problem with you, it's better to go back and get it right with him than it is to come and present your offering. That's amazing. How many times have you ever been in a worship service before and seen somebody jump up and run out the back, and then you found out later that they had gotten in an argument with somebody during the week, and they realized that their priority was to get right with that person before they got right with God? This is drastic here. Jesus says, don't come to God in a worship context and say, oh God, I'm here to worship you. When you've got somebody else in your life that you're unforgiving toward, that you've got a conflict with, this is radical. Jesus is very serious about this. He says, be quick about getting things resolved with other people. In 1 John, this principle is reinforced because in 1 John, John says, how can you say you love God whom you've never seen if you don't love your brother whom you have seen? If you can't work out your relationships with one another, or at least try to resolve the conflicts, how can you stand before God and say, God, I love you, I worship you, and everything's all right between me and you? That's strong. But Jesus says, get your human relations straightened out. Don't mess around with this. Anger is too dangerous to just hang on. It's too dangerous of a fire to hold in the palm of your hand and not expect to get burnt. You see, anger starts in the heart, and leads to the hand that holds the gun. That's where it starts. The other example he gives, verse 25, he says, make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge and the judge to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. What's the context here? We've got a business situation here. And the picture is here's this guy with briefs under one arm, with attorney at the other side, and he's headed to court. He's going to take you to court. And here you are beside him the whole way saying, hey, come on, can't we get this settled? Can't we work this out? I mean, there's got to be a way we can work this out. That's the kind of attitude that we as Christian people ought to have. Be quick to settle your disputes, whether they're family related, whether they're relationships with other relatives, whether they're friends, whether they're legal. No matter what it is, anger is so dangerous. And the potential for harm is so great, both to us and other people, that we've got to be quick and be actively involved in settling our disputes and our problems with other people. We ought to be the one that's always making the first move to try to right wrongs. Just on a practical note, what do you do when you go to somebody and you say, hey, I'm sorry, I've wronged you? And the person doesn't accept that. And the person still carries a grudge. Does that mean you can never come back and worship again? No, it absolutely doesn't mean that. The focus here is on you doing all that you can to try to right wrongs. Whether the anger's in your heart or their heart, you do all you can. Once you've done all you can, then you need to commit it to the Lord in prayer and pray regularly for that person. But ultimately, in every situation, both people have a free will. And you, by your desiring to make things right, will never be able to force the other person to do what's right. So you try the best you can, and you pray, and you work towards resolution. But if the other person won't allow the forgiveness to take place, you're kind of stuck there. You continue on with your Christian life. You continue to be involved in the worship of God and move forward. But if you're the one who's causing it, particularly, you better deal with it before God. That's too convicting. Let's move into this other area. This is less convicting. Is it? Remember, these are Jesus' words. When I go through the Sermon on the Mount, I got to keep reminding you all, this is not me. I'm not saying this. I'm just telling you what Jesus is saying. Because these are strong, and they run so countercultural. This is so different than what our society promotes that we've got to be real, real careful not to assume that this is the teaching of Hill Country Bible or this is the teaching of Tim Hawks or this is the teaching of any individual. This is what Jesus is saying. 27, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Pharisees' interpretation of committing adultery of the seventh commandment, don't take your neighbor's wife, was that you are okay before God as long as you don't engage in sexual activity with another person. That's when you become guilty. If at any point in time you get involved sexually with another person, you've broken God's law. Okay? But up to that point, up to the physical involvement, you're okay. You haven't done anything wrong. Let's look at what Jesus says, what God's intended meaning was. Jesus says, verse 28, but I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. That everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Jesus says that guilt begins with lustful looking. That's where it starts. Now, we've got to understand this passage because this passage has been abused by lots and lots of people. So let's look at it closely. The word looking there is not a casual glance. It's a purposeful gaze. Look at how he says it. He says that everyone who looks on a woman to lust, that's the intent of the looking. Anyone who sees a woman and looks at her with an intent to lust after her. That's his purpose in making the look in the first place. Anybody that does that has already committed adultery in his heart. You see, from then on, the looking is just the acting out, is just the acting out of what's already taken place in the heart. So, say if I were to come into a room and I were to see somebody and I were to lust after that person, then what I would be doing in breaking this commandment here would be looking at that person and thinking the lustful activity out in my heart. And the looking would simply be the satisfying or satisfying that evil desire that was already there and was already growing there. It's real important that we understand this as we try to apply this, because it's really important that just a casual glance driving down the street and you see somebody on the side of the road or something like that and you look over at them, that's not wrong. What's wrong is when the intent of the heart is lustful and the eyes are simply gratifying what's already taking place in the heart. Let me make a couple observations here. The first observation is this is not written just to men. You say, well, it says to look on a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery in his heart. That's generic. It would have been normal in Jesus' day for when Jesus was addressing a mixed group to speak of man as in terms of mankind, to speak of woman in terms of womankind, much today like we use the pronouns he and she. But normally we use the male pronoun when we're talking about a generic group of people. Well, that's what Jesus is doing here, and he could have just as easily addressed the women and said, women, when you look on a man to lust in your heart, you've committed adultery too. And a lot of times we look at this passage and we say, well, men look and lust and women don't look and lust. And that's not true at all. That's not true at all. So, gals, you don't get off the hook here. Second observation I want to make sure you understand is that the glance is not the sin. The glance is not the sin. If I'm driving down the street and somebody walks by and they're provocatively dressed and I look over at them and I recognize that they're provocatively dressed, have I sinned yet? No. But when I turn back again and think, boy, whew, did you see that? Boy, that gets me all hot and bothered. And then I look at that person. Then I'm sinning. You know, it doesn't take very long between look number one and look number two. Okay? The third observation that I want to make is that the whole problem of lust is a problem in marriage that's shared by both the husband and the wife. Now, let me clarify that because it's really important to notice. When you say, I do we have any such thing as his problems or her problems anymore? We don't. Now there are problems. If I have a problem with overeating, is it my problem? Is it my wife's? Does my wife stand back and say, yeah, you know, that husband of mine, he's worthless and he overeats and he just, you know, that's his problem? No, not anymore, because we're married. We're one flesh. And all the problems that I have in my life are shared by Cindy, and all the problems she has in her life are shared by me. And it's my responsibility before God as a husband to help her and encourage her and help her work through the problems that she has. And it's her responsibility as a wife to help me and encourage me and help me work through the problems that I have. That's the whole point of being married, to be better together than you were separately, to help each other, to build on each other's strengths, to help each other with their weaknesses. Now, what happens traditionally if one of the two partners in a marriage has a problem with lust? Well, they sure don't tell the other partner, do they? Because that's personally offensive. Now, if one of the two partners has a problem with self-restraint in the area of eating, usually the partners work together as a team on it. If you have a problem of self-restraint in the area of alcohol, many times a wife or a husband will be very understanding and work with you and help you to work through that. If you have a problem in the area of lust, you're on your own. Wives, in this society, that's so full, not only of opportunities, but propaganda out there that entice your husband to lust. And husbands, the same for your wives. If we don't work together on this problem area, if we isolate ourselves from each other in this area, we're setting ourselves up for failure. We need to communicate. We need to be open with each other. We need to be understanding. We need to be praying together for this. And if you're struggling with a lust problem, you don't want to wait until it's already in adultery before your wife finds out about it or before your husband finds out about it. You need to be communicating with each other. Because wives, you will help your husbands more than anyone in the area of helping him to understand what's going on around him, what he's being tempted by, who's in his life that he needs to alienate himself from or move away. And husbands, you'll be the best person for your wife in helping her. And we as a church have got to demythologize this whole area of lust and really work together and recognize it's a problem. It's a problem in our society. It's a problem in our churches. It's a problem in our marriages. And the only way we're going to help each other is by talking about it and encouraging each other and building a marriage where the kind of openness and honesty can be there, to where a wife can pray with her husband about that area, a husband can pray with his wife about that area, and we can overcome it with God's help. It's very important not to go through this alone, not to fight this battle all by yourself. What's the response? The response is kind of staggering. But before I get into the response, I want to give you some statistics. We all hear and we all know that this is a sex-crazed society, but let me tell you exactly what's going on out there. Let's look at teens first. Do you know that nearly one-third of teens between the ages of 12 to 17 have lost their virginity? One-third. And 57% had sex by the time they were 17. Almost 60% of our high school kids have had sex by the time they're 17. That was a 1987 statistic. Let's go to college. On the college level, 76% of the males, that's three-quarters, and 59% of the females have had sexual intercourse. 59% of males and 60% of females said premarital sex was appropriate if the couple were in love or felt strongly about each other. Let's skip the men. Let's go to the adult women. This is a 1986 statistic. Shocking. In a survey of 30,000 women, 41% had been unfaithful. This is adult women. That's 4 out of 10 have been unfaithful. And about 25% of the single women ages 35 to 65 are involved in long-term relationships with married men. 25% of the women 35 to 65 are involved in long-term relationships with married men. That means 1 out of 4 of the gals at the place where your husband works, women, are involved with a man in a long-term relationship. Does that scare you a little bit? That's high. Working women are more likely to have an extramarital affair. 57% met their lovers on the job. As women move more and more into the workforce, women are struggling more and more in this area of lust and the area of immorality and the area of adultery. What's our response to this? Jesus says, verse 29, "If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you that one of the parts of your body than your whole body, that one of your parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than your whole body go into hell." That's strong. First of all, let me tell you what Jesus is not saying. Jesus is not saying physically maim yourself. Is he? If he was saying that, if that was the prevention to do an external cure for an internal problem, then he's contradicting what he's just been saying. Saying what we need is a change in the heart, because that's where sin starts. That's where murder starts, right here with anger. Lust starts right here in the heart. So he's not saying physically maim yourself. He's saying in very, very graphic terms, you better take radical steps in this area of lust to ensure that you're not involved in it. See, the right hand and the right eye were considered the two best parts of a person in the ancient world. It was with the right hand that you worked. That was your strong hand. It was with your right eye that you could see. And in the ancient world where most of the labor was done physically, those were very important parts. And a guy who lost his right arm was really crippled from making a livelihood. And a guy who had his right eye put out, he was very handicapped. And Jesus is saying, if it comes between lust and the important things in life, the things that you value highly, you better give up the things that you value highly to get out of a lustful situation. Remember Joseph in Potiphar's house? He was the Hebrew slave that had the master's wife that was always chasing him around. And what happened when she finally got a hold of him? Boy, he left his coat there in her arms and ran out the door. Radical, radical steps. And Jesus says it would be better for you to give up the best things that you have, even to your right eye and your right hand, in order to avoid lust. Maybe you've got a friendship that you need to break it off because you've already moved into the area of lust. Maybe there's somebody at work that's got you so messed up with lust that you need to find another job. You say, man, that is radical. What's Jesus saying here? Take radical steps. Maybe you need to sell your home and move into a different neighborhood because you've got neighbors that are causing you a problem in this area. I guess the question that it comes down to and the question that Jesus is asking is, how willing are you and how much do you desire purity? How much do you desire to be righteous on the inside? Whatever it takes, take radical steps. I would also add the TV programs we watch, the magazines we read. You know, it used to be that there were a certain group of magazines that you saw on the way out the store that, you know, kind of everybody chuckled at because those were the smut magazines. But now they mail, they've kind of glorified these magazines, given them a glossy cover, and they mail them to our homes. And we can read about all the movie stars that are involved with so-and-so and the divorces that are taking place between them and, you know, the kinky things that are going on in this world. And, boy, it's socially acceptable to read all that and to look at all that stuff now. And all we're doing is pumping things into our mind that just have no business being there. The TV shows that we watch nowadays, you can't sit down and watch network television for an evening and not see at least one lovemaking scene. And usually if you start at 7 and watch till 10, you'll see 3 of them. Now, 10 years ago, they used to rate those things R. And now we watch them on television. Music. For those of you who are in high school, I'm not talking about the beat. I'm not talking about the style. I'm not even talking about the way the people dress. Are you evaluating what they're saying? What they're encouraging you to do?